So I'm Emma Connors, Managing Editor of The Interpreter, and I'm here with Roger Shanahan, who, with Lydia Khalil, has co-authored a new Lowy Institute report titled Foreign Fighters in Syria and Iraq, The Day After. Roger, let's talk firstly about the growing threat posed by returning jihadists. So far, the focus has been pretty firmly on defeating Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, but now we need to look beyond that, right?
Yeah, that's correct. For all the good reasons, people have been trying to prevent foreign fighters travelling to Syria and Iraq to gain experience. Now, as Islamic State's momentum has not only been halted, but has shifted decisively against it, agencies really need to start looking at the day after what's happening to these foreign fighters once Islamic State is defeated, and furthermore, once there's a political solution in Syria and the foreign fighters that are with other jihadi groups are no longer able to remain inside Syria.
You make the point in your report that this threat should not be viewed as a purely national one, affecting only those countries with citizens who have become foreign fighters. So if we shouldn't perceive it as a national threat, I guess the answer is as a regional or international threat, but that is a big challenge for security agencies and legislators, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the hardest issue to grapple with. You know, more than 95% of Australians who've been victims of terrorist attacks have become victims overseas, so not within Australia. So there's two elements to this. Some of those foreign fighters, Australian foreign fighters, will seek to come back to Australia, and some are already here. Intelligence agencies and security agencies need to have a good understanding of their networks when they're in Iraq and Syria to understand how they interacted with other jihadis. And the other problem, on the problem side for the intelligence and security agencies, is prosecuting these people when they come back. Not because we don't have good legislation, but the evidentiary basis of taking it to court, that's a really difficult issue. And it'd be interesting to see when we get the first foreign fighter case going to court in Victoria later this year or early next year to see how courts view evidence that has been gathered. On the other issue about overseas, there's a range of issues that's going to make it very difficult for security agencies to diminish, let alone destroy, this threat. There are thousands of foreign fighters who are going to be dispersed throughout the Middle East region and further afield after the conflict. People really need to understand the networks that they've been working within to therefore understand who they interact with after. These people will have skill sets and operational experience that when it's exposed to other willing volunteers who never went to Iraq and Syria will make those groups more capable. And probably the third element is while we have good foreign fighter legislation and robust foreign fighter legislation in Australia, that's not the case with all other countries, and we have to remember that the vast majority of foreign fighters come from the Middle East region. They don't come from the West. So even with these regional foreign fighters, if they're known and they return to their own countries, in a number of countries, there's not the legislative basis to prosecute them or prosecute them to the degree to which we would believe means that their threat has been removed.
Do you think, in terms of what countries they will be targeting, the legislation and the nature of the legislation in those countries will affect their targets?
Well, it's from what we've seen in the past, you know, these groups will want to target, you know, a couple of things. One, depending on how the government treats them, they will try and target government and security institutions. We've already seen Islamic State in particular target Western targets, so that might be Western holidaymakers in these countries. And we've seen in Paris and Belgium just ordinary Europeans going about their daily business. So I think the legislative issue is important insofar as it allows people to deal with returning foreign fighters only once they get to their countries of origin. But we also need to have a much more integrated system of intelligence sharing so that this information that people are gathering is shared not only as widely as possible but in as timely a fashion as possible. And I think what we saw again in Paris, but more particularly in Belgium was the pitfalls when this intelligence sharing isn't as tightly organised as it could be.
On the issue of shared intelligence, given the experience now fighting the various Islamic State groups in Syria and Iraq, obviously countries have been sharing information, those who've been involved in the fighting. Will that help them share information the day after?
Well, this is a good question, and one of the kind of questions that this whole conflict raises is some of the people who've been, some of the countries who've been fighting Islamic State, Jabhat Fatah al-Sham and other jihadi groups in these countries, such as Russia and Iran, lie on opposite ideological sides from the West. Now, does that mean that we shouldn't share information and intelligence with them within the parameters of returning foreign fighters? Absolutely not, and I think pragmatically we have to. They're going to have some of access to some of the best sources of intelligence and information as they take, particularly in Syria, as they take ground from Islamic State. It's going to throw up a trove of intelligence information. The kind of intercepts that they would have conducted during the operations will throw up information about the nature of networks, who worked with who. All of this kind of stuff is gold for intelligence agencies in this era of kind of globalised jihadi terrorism. So the harsh reality is we're going to have to deal with these countries. The question then becomes, are they going to share all of the information, or are they only going to share selected pieces of information? You would have to assume that it's the latter, but some information is going to be better than no information. So there has to be some channels open between ourselves and other Western countries and these governments, with the understanding that you're not going to get all of the information, but you're going to, whatever you get is going to be better than not having it.
I guess one way of looking at it is that we're going to have to develop a new level of trusting with a certain amount of distrust the information we get in this area.
Yeah, I think if there's one area of common, a common perception of threat is amongst all these states is the threat posed by radical jihadist terrorists. And so if you can't get a degree of cooperation on that, you're not going to get much cooperation anywhere else. But as with all of these kind of interactions, Western intelligence agencies should go into it with their eyes wide open, and I don't think there's any reason why they wouldn't. And I think the public has going to have to be understanding of the fact that national governments will deal with governments of nations with which we may have very few other common interests except this one.
Mm. Well, we look forward, hopefully, to some level of cooperation that will help us meet the threat.
I think there will be, because it's in everybody's best interest to do that. Sharing information is one aspect, though. Dealing with it, and dealing with it not necessarily in a kinetic fashion, but in a law enforcement and judicial fashion, is going to be another set of problems that we're going to face.
Okay, well, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.